Okay, this is board time, Wednesday, October 7th at 1:30 p.m.
Okay, thank you. The first thing on the list here is approved minutes for September 30. I understand, Mark, that there's an update to those?
Yes.
Has it already been integrated?
Into the minutes? No.
Okay.
Jennifer's undertaking that.
Okay.
So, if you want to just bring them back next week with those additions or approve them subject to those... additions.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Okay.
Give you time to
do that.
Do
you have multiple copies of that, or did each of the board members?
Yeah, everybody got a copy.
Okay. So.
Give everybody the opportunity to do that. Bring that back next week.
Sure.
I'm good with that. Okay. So moving on to 2.1, draft Remote Transactions Parity Act and Cadillac Tax Letters to Congressional Delegation.
Okay, a number of weeks ago, Councilors Mark Gassaway came to my one-on-one sessions with you and presented you with draft memos on both subjects. And just for the purposes of refreshing your memory, I'll turn the floor over to him and just let him explain again what we're trying to do.
There's two issues that are nationally that are going through Congress right now. The first one has to do with the Remote Transaction Parity Act, which is an effort to ensure that sales tax states like Washington State is receiving their fair share of sales tax on online sales. Mm-hmm. And so it levels the playing field between online vendors and those with brick and mortar stores like we have here. It's not a new tax, it's just an extension of an existing program that we already have. There's two separate bills that are already being introduced. We're encouraging our local delegation to sign on as co-sponsors of those bills, or at least show their support. And I would anticipate that being a sales tax state, we've already taken measures to try and work with a coalition of states to ensure that we are receiving this. And this would be setting a federal standard. So there's already certain agreements in place, but this makes it standardized throughout the United States. The second one is addressing the Cadillac tax, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, which will take effect in 2018. And what it imposes is a 40% excise tax on any benefits paid to employees over a certain threshold. And that is a new tax, and that would be a burden that is placed on employers to respond to.
Sure.
And so, and again, also there are bills being introduced currently in Congress, and we're asking our local representatives to support those.
Sure.
So,
if you don't mind, I'd like to be able to address them individually.
Sure.
Certainly, the second one makes sense. I think it's pretty obvious on its face that the Unaffordable Care Act is can be improved by by removing that 40% penalty. The one ahead of that, I do not support, and the want to make sure that we differentiate two different things there. One is sales tax revenue to local governments and states. It's a good thing. Support that. However, to have the federal government enforce local and state law is to me a violation of the basic fundamental role of the federal government. So it's not the what, it's the how. And the it's an extension far beyond what our federal government's role has been up to this point. So I want to make sure that we don't get this wrong. I support the idea, and I support as much as we can to be able to collect local sales tax. Got that. But it is not the role of the federal government to enforce local law and to somehow have one state reach into other states and have their tax laws imposed on other states. So it's the how that I cannot support on both the House version and the Senate version of that bill.
And just so you know, it doesn't change any of the local tax laws. It doesn't,
I understand.
Say Washington.
Yeah, got that.
It's just saying that if you sell into Washington, then you would be subject to Washington State's tax laws.
Yeah, the problem is that Washington, how that gets implemented is the federal government would extend the right of Washington's government to go in after citizens in other states. Yeah. That's, to me, completely the wrong way to do this. I don't want to empower our federal government to somehow grant it's that kind of authority. So it's the how that I have problems.
May I pose a question to our counsel?
Mm-hmm.
Chris, the federal government regulates interstate commerce. Is that correct?
Yes.
If a citizen of this state buys a good from another state, does that qualify as interstate commerce and therefore subject to federal government regulation?
Well, in its broadest sense, yes. Congress has been involved, and the Supreme Court has on a number of occasions dabbled in the area where local states attempted to, through local actions, impact interstate commerce. It can happen if you're taxing, giving special tax priorities to local products as opposed to interstate products. That seems to discriminate against one over the other, and that's been an area where the Supreme Court has said that that's an interference with, or it's a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. There are cases when it's been approved. In fact, I won't go into it, but when a local action impacts the sales between states, or the ability from somebody from another state to sell products in the United or in the state of Washington, potentially you're involved in this, but it's a pretty complicated area and it's fairly fact specific, and so you don't want to ask. This is not a question you generally ask on a very 10,000 foot level. You really need to know fairly specific facts. They typically, these kinds of cases, when they are decided by any court, are very fact intensive, and the court usually will say in this case, and it's because they intend it to be a fairly limited analysis, because they recognize you're dealing with the rights of two different states, the citizens of two different states, together with the rights of the federal government to accommodate all states in their ability to conduct commerce. And so it's a fairly complicated process. So I can tell you a little, but before you do this, we dealt with this on AMR when we had our litigation with regard to the ambulance service and whether it violated antitrust laws. We've had to deal with it on only a couple of occasions over the last 10 years, and like I say, every time I've gotten into it, it takes a long time to get your feet wet, and then once you do, you find that it's good for just that case, and then you've got to almost start all over again when you start back in on it.
Okay.
I have a question along that line. Is it the state law then that exempts businesses that ship their products from here that makes it exempt?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by exempt. If there is a transaction, so for example, are we talking about, for example, internet transactions where people are purchasing remotely?
Well, it could be, but I guess what I'm thinking of, If I sell a product on eBay, for example,
mm-hmm.
and I was the manufacturer of that product, and it goes to Oregon, I think I'm exempt from paying sales tax on that.
Actually, well, remember, Washington has both sales tax for products sold within the United or within the state of Washington, but it also has a use tax. So, I mean, the fact that you buy your dishwasher over at Costco over across mm-hmm. the river, if it were to happen that the state patrol stopped you on the bridge, that they could make you go to the Department of Revenue and pay use tax, even today, on the purchase you made over in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you buy something on eBay, in the appropriate circumstance, you can be required to pay use tax on that transaction even today. It's just that there's not really a formal mechanism, with the exception of companies who do a large enough quantity of business that they've either entered into agreements with the state of Washington or agreed to abide by those. Amazon's a good example. Amazon.com has made it a practice that when they transact business, that they will collect sales tax for whatever states they ship in. Whereas if you buy individual products from smaller dealers that may be in Michigan, wherever, pick a place,
so
frequently they don't charge sales tax.
Yeah, so I think you've got a little bit backwards of where I was going with that.
I'm sorry, I was just
so
trying to get
I'll
you
use
background.
I'll use another example.
Okay.
I make hot tubs here in the state of Washington.
Okay.
And I'm going to send a truckload over to Oregon. I believe I'm tax exempt if I sell it to Oregon.
If you sell it to a wholesaler, you absolutely are exempt because a retail transaction has not occurred and it's not taxable.
No, that's end state the same way.
That's true, to a wholesaler. If you sell it to a retailer, I would want to do a little more research. And the state has become, the Department of Revenue has become a lot more active in this area, and I know about it. Natural gas is a good example because there was just a case in the last year that dealt with an out-of-state shipper who brought natural gas in from Canada, and the question became, at what point was that, did they become the owner of it, and when it was subject to taxes? And so all this is a fairly complicated area that's in flux, but I can tell you the Department of Revenue has become a lot more active in trying to collect money.
I guess that's kind of along the way what we're talking about is that we exempt sales, things that are produced here and shipped to another state, we exempt them from that sales tax, I believe.
Wholesale. If they're sold retail, the question becomes, where does the sale occur? You know, all this because I'm not trying to make it complicated. It just tends to be that way. It depends on where the transaction is construed as taking place. If the transaction happens in Washington, you're supposed to collect sales tax. If the transaction and the consummation of the deal actually happens out of state, interstate transactions, I don't believe, are currently subject to Washington state sales tax. So it is you need to answer some questions that, given your hypothetical, I can't tell you the answer to.
So I'm going to bring back to Mike, and my question, Mike, is that's one of the targets that we're looking for?
No.
It's not.
No. Right now there's a coalition of 28 states that have an agreement of collecting sales tax in the state of destination. So, and Washington is also a destination-based state. So wherever the delivery takes place is where the sales tax occurs. So Washington is part of that current coalition. What the Fairness Act does, it gives a even application of law amongst all 50 states, rather than just those that are part of the current coalition. So wherever the destination is, your example of a sale into Oregon, because they are a non-sales tax state, there would be no sales tax collected. However, but if it's sold in California, which is part of the coalition, then they would be charged whatever California's rates are.
I think there are still exceptions to that.
And there are exceptions.
If you purchase solely for the purpose of resale.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you're a wholesaler.
It's a different, whole different mechanism. You do not pay tax, nor does the receiving wholesaler.
And the Marketplace Fairness Act only addresses retail sales. It's only the final sale into the consumer.
So explain to me, Washington Association of Cities, what do we call it? AWC, Association of Washington Cities, worked with the legislature to pass a measure in the state of Washington where it was, if you were selling something to a Washington resident on a retail basis, you were required to collect that at the point of sale, whether it was an internet sale or whatever. What I'm confused by, and everybody was on board, and that is the Washington state law, so why is this not a function of the Department of Revenue to be enforcing this?
I don't think the Washington State Department of Revenue has jurisdiction over interstate sales. This is sales between different states.
Well, the Association of Washington Cities worked at the local and national level to ensure, and the whole reason for it was to close the gap on missed sales tax at the retail level. And it was a big deal. I can remember it was a big deal, and it was considered a huge success, and legislation was passed here, and there was some coalition at the federal level. So I'm wondering why that didn't work.
Well, we do have, they did pass the legislation in Washington State, which was called the Streamlined Sales Tax Initiative.
Yes.
That's where the sales tax is collected at the point of delivery,
yes,
rather than the point of shipping.
Well, it's the point of use. It's considered the point of use.
Right. And so that's the current law in Washington. So if you are a consumer and you receive something, it's taxed at wherever it's delivered at, versus okay, if you ship it to Eastern Washington and they have a lower tax rate, then it's collected at that rate.
And some online purchases charge you sales tax,
yes,
and some do not.
And that's part of the coalition that I explained earlier.
The 28 states that are part of the coalition will collect the sales tax and remit it to the state of Washington. The other 22 states do not. And this is simply trying to level the playing field. And it will benefit brick-and-mortar businesses in our community, because the relative advantage that Internet retailers have that are in those 22 states will disappear.
If
well,
you don't mind,
like
we
8% by 8% sales differential or cost differential.
And there's just one other comment. With the growth of online sales and the projection of growth and the lost revenue that our county will experience, it's only going to increase. So the longer we go into this technology phase of our society, the more online sales, the greater the loss will be to our county.
We have a number of things to get through and a limited time to do it. I understand, Chris, you have to leave by 3:30.
Yeah,
I'd like people to crank through this. The bottom line is that I can see we can talk about the advantages. There are lots of advantages to collecting sales tax. Got that. However, the method of empowering this state to go after citizens in other states, to me, is an inappropriate extension of authority outside of the borders of the state. So I do not support it. I'd like to be able to see if we can get to the point where we can vote not to support this. I move that we not support these two bills associated with this. Is there a second?
I don't want to second that. What I would rather do is bring this back next week, where we have time, because clearly we don't understand this as well as we should about what the implications are. So rather than pass it or not pass it, I'd like to see us hold it over and make sure that I understand your point. You don't want to encourage legislation that gives the federal government authority over areas they don't currently have authority over, right?
Right, and I don't think it's appropriate for one state to have authority over the citizens in another state.
Well,
so hearing no second,
sure.
I guess we'll...
I'd like to have brought back two. Along that line, why hasn't the state of Washington joined the coalition of 28 states?
We are
a part of that coalition. So there's something not happening. Something's not working in that coalition.
And as Mark said, basically what it does, it includes those states that aren't part of the coalition. They would play by the same rules.
Yeah, the 28 that are part of the coalition are collecting the taxes and remitting them to the various states. The other 22 states are not.
I have a problem with that. I don't want to mandate Oregon do something. I don't want Oregon mandate that I do something.
Oregon wouldn't be an issue because they're
Idaho, Montana. I don't want to mandate another state. If the other state wants to voluntarily come in, I can accept that. And I would think that I would encourage us to go that direction, working with our local legislators to work in that direction rather than go the other direction.
So it really has to do with forcing the other 22 states to join that coalition or have the federal government obsolete the coalition and just say this is federal law that one state can reach into the citizens' pockets of another state. We'll bring that back next week. Okay, moving on to...
The Cadillac tax, though, did we agree on that aspect?
Oh, I'm good with that.
May I please clarify what you just said, Mr. Chair? The people paying the sales tax would be people of our own state. Because when you give them your credit card number to pay for a good that you're ordering from one of the states that are not part of the coalition, they will now charge you sales tax. So if I order something from West Virginia and I don't pay sales tax on it now, if this law passes, the next time I buy something, I will pay 7.7% or 7.9%. So we're not forcing the citizens of another state to pay taxes. We're just having our own citizens pay the taxes that they would have paid if they bought it in a store inside Clark County.
So actually, this here does force the citizens in the other state to pay. I'd like to be able to move on from that, Mark.
Okay. Well,
I want to bring it back.
Okay.
There was something here a while back that happened during cigarette sales. So the state of Washington went after those individuals that were buying cigarettes from another state on a commercial basis or something. Mm-hmm. Do you know how that worked out, how that came?
I'm not familiar.
Okay. It's a heavy fine. And they watch constantly for people that transport or ship.
It was our state going after our citizens for the purchase in another state. So somehow, some type of coalition notified the state of Washington that somebody was buying cigarettes in Alabama or something.
It's a tobacco tax. It's a state tobacco tax.
Federal, I think.
Both.
Okay.
Both.
The letters having to do with the 40% tax, the Cadillac tax. I'm good with the idea. I would like to strike a few sentences out of there that are not necessary. If you look at the letter mark, there's one, two, the third paragraph. I like to just strike out the second and the third sentence and the last sentence. The rest of it, I'm good with that.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, strike out the second and third sentence and the third paragraph. The paragraph that starts, this tax has particular consequences for state and local governments. That paragraph.
Yeah.
So strike out
the
second and third sentence and the last sentence. Otherwise, and if you do that, I'm good with it.
Well, why are...
This is...
Why were those sentences included? I want to know who drafted it. Whoever drafted it and who put those sentences in, please, can you share with us what the meaning or purpose of those were? Do you have a copy?
Mark, can I borrow you? I'm not sure.
I'll read the sentences.
I want to ask, and don't interrupt me again, I'm asking for the person who drafted it to tell us why they included the information they included.
The reason why those sentences were included is because traditionally state and local governments have balanced their compensation packages with benefits as opposed to salaries. We've used that to attract employees. So at the state and local level, a greater proportion of our compensation packages is paid through benefits. Therefore, the amount of tax that will be imposed upon state and local governments will be a greater proportion. And that's really what that's referring to.
So tell us again which sentence that is.
That's the second and third sentence.
Of which paragraph?
Paragraph 3.
Paragraph 3.
Second, third. So, what makes you say there is a disparity in salaries between public and private? Because I think that's shrinking. I think the disparity is shrinking.
The studies that have been done, and I can share those with you if you'd like, have typically shown a disparity, particularly at the professional level, between state and local governments and private businesses.
So I may not agree with your assessment of that.
And I can just show you. I can show you the study. Sorry.
I know there are studies. And then in the third sentence, mm-hmm. in order to remain competitive, is that mm-hmm. the third sentence that's suggested to be stricken?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I do think that statement has some validity, that that we need to remain competitive, but offering better benefits as a more significant portion, I don't know about. We can think about that for a minute. And then was there a third,
the last sentence
in that same paragraph?
Yes.
Why would you strike?
Because
second part. I'm sorry, I thought you were done.
Almost. So, I don't think it's fair to say that we'll lose our best and brightest, but I do think it's fair to say government must retain it, the best and the brightest, or if not that phrase, the highly competent or whatever.
And again, this was a draft for your approval, so if you would like to edit this, that is certainly your problem.
I think I agree that it could stand some modification.
Sure.
And so that's my opinion on those areas. And Tom, I'm sure, has some opinions too.
Tom?
On the second suggested striking, I wouldn't strike the whole sentence. I think it's great to put it out there that a reduction of these benefits will make state and local governments compensation less competitive with the private sector. I think the consequences is irrelevant for the purpose of the letter. So I would leave the first half of that compound sentence and end at private sector. We recognize that our benefits are very lucrative to attract good employees. And it's like even if you're in the private sector, you provide either a higher wage or more benefits to attract people to your business or to your place of employment. But I don't think there's a consequence that needs to be spelled out here because it affects everybody else differently.
In this case, I think we're singling out government as different from private sector. That any organization, whether it be private sector, business, they all are hit by this 40% tax. If they offer good benefits to their employees, they're all hit. And I want to make sure that we keep in mind who pays the bills around here, which is the private sector. And we want to make sure that the private sector has every advantage, and that somehow in our own tone that we don't somehow prefer an advantage for the public sector. These are based upon the idea that the public, we pay less around here than the people that pay the bills out there in the private sector. I don't think that's true.
Okay, so let's strike sentence one.
Okay, I agree.
Two and three. And then I support Councillor Mielke's modification of the last sentence, just striking the consequences.
That's fine. Are you good with that?
Sounds good.
And that sentence of private sector.
All right. We can do that and move on.
Okay.
And now we got the Shalachie Railroad. Is everybody okay with that?
Where are we?
Oh.
That one.
Yeah, I need to point out on that document that if you agree with the letter, you are making a financial commitment that will be incorporated in the readopted budget when it's approved in December.
Mm. That's a road fund, right?
No, that would be general fund match. I think
we're paying general fund for the railroad.
Yeah, railroad is not a road fund activity. It's
a transportation activity.
But it's at the state level, but not here.
But it's not
really
appropriate to spend road fund unless you have a point of intersection at a railroad crossing across a county road. then you blend funds appropriately to get the work done. But between road crossings, it's all funded by state grant money, federal grant money, and our general fund.
Heath, have we explored the every option to make sure that the road fund cannot cover this transportation means?
Yeah, because it's specific to county roads, so the county doesn't. The railroad isn't considered a roadway, so based on the definition, that the funds can't be used unless the railroad crosses the actual roadway.
And the state auditor studies that intensively when they come every year to do their accountability audit.
Is there a particular grant that's been identified?
Yes, there's supporting material, I think, behind his letter.
One thing very important is that every legislative session, we have been able to secure about $2 million.
Right.
Without having to go to a match. I don't think that we have funds today to do a match. And if you're looking for a match, then I'd turn around and I would look at our road fund. And I don't think I think we have other plans for the road fund. So
I
wouldn't support the letter as written.
The grant that is being applied for is $970,000, and it's to put a 135-pound rail in place of the lighter rail that we have going up the hill. And the local match to qualify for that $970,000 in state money is $194,000. So for every dollar we commit in match, we get $4 if we're successful in applying for the grant.
I think one of the confusions is that the materials that explain that weren't with my copy of the letter, and I don't know if, and now it could have been, and that I attached it to an earlier draft of board time because we've had several revisions, but I don't have that packet that explains that either.
As a rule, we've been given about $12,000 a year. Out of the general fund.
Well, I really would like to have the benefit of seeing that because I did call Jeff yesterday and ask for detail, and he called me back late in the day. But if we could just rerun this next week where we have the full information,
Unfortunately, the deadline's Friday, so. And why it's being brought to you at this late date, I'll have to have a conversation with Jeff about that.
If I can, Councilor Madure, I just want to let you know that your concern about the road fund. The road fund, in terms of what it can be spent on, is in 3680240, and it talks about for establishing, laying out, constructing, altering, repairing, improving, and maintaining county roads, bridges, and wharves necessary for vehicle ferriage, and, you know, for other proper public purposes or county purposes. But the state has been, the road fund has been dabbled with by counties in the past, and the state let us get away with it for a time, and they've tightened it up little by little, and they've become pretty, I think the comment that the auditor tends to follow the road fund is a pretty accurate one, because of there's a lot of money in it, and it, people tend to think, you know, that they can use it for other purposes. But it's pretty narrow, and that statute, none of that talks to about anything that relates to a railroad. So, no, I don't believe you could use it for, in fact, the issue came up, could we use it for, use REIT for this, and I specifically looked at whether REIT 1 or 2 could be used, and it can't be. So the road fund is, absolutely does not qualify.
Okay, thanks for the clear answer, Chris.
State law governing county road funds.
Mm-hmm.
A little ironic because the state uses their highway taxes for railroads.
We're not that.
I got you.
Yeah.
I can't support the way it is.
How much has the general fund participated in the railroad project in the past? Is this a renewal of what we've previously done?
No, we've obtained, I think, about $6 million in state grants to rehabilitate various parts of the railroad, and we contribute general fund match to qualify for those grants. In the absence of this $194,000, we forego the opportunity to get $970,000 from the state, and you know the railroad figures into our economic development plan along the railroad corridor. And as we do the site readiness study and we have the industrial land bank here, having high quality heavy rail to get rail cars up the hill and to their destination is important, and will be more competitive for businesses locating here if they know that we're committed to building a good high quality railroad system in the county. Otherwise, people might look elsewhere. So we've committed in the past to making improvements incrementally to the line, and it's been a while since we've successfully obtained a grant. And we want to stay on the board. We want to be active, and we want the state to think about us every budget cycle. And so, you know, I'd strongly recommend that you commit this $194,000, and I guarantee you that I can find it.
So
I don't recall, since I've been here, that we've ever did a matching grant for the railroad project.
I'll lay it out for you in a second.
Okay. I know we have been able to pull about $2 million a biennium, which didn't require that match because we never had that match before. And I think that we've already paid for, and it's either under construction or being constructed all the way up to 78th Street now with the heavy rail.
I'm not sure.
Well, it'd be a good thing to go back and review, because we've had, like I said, $6 million invested in that, and I believe that that's what it was.
Yeah.
But I don't think under current budget that we have the extra money to do that right now. Not with other things in the works.
Mark, you just said something. I guarantee I can find it. Can you elaborate on that?
I believe that when we bring a budget to you that is balanced, if this $194,000 is in there in a many multi-million dollar budget, that we can afford to do it.
Well, the question is, can you identify savings someplace in order to come up with that?
Well, what we need to do is show you a balance between revenues and expenses. And if we can do that, then...
No. The question is, can you find savings?
I'll repeat.
Are you as confident?
I don't need to find
$194,000
in spending to get rid of. What I need to do is bring you a budget that's balanced. That's what I'm required to do.
But we'll help to balance it.
So is the general fund ask 194, or is it 20% of the 194?
No, it's 194 is the 20% of the total project
is
cost.
The 20. So for the 194,000, what's the total amount that we reap for that?
Nine.
194 is 20% of what?
194 plus 970 is 1,164,000.
But that's the maximum of what we're saying. So we're saying what we're asking for is authority to accept an amount of money that 194,000 is 20% of.
Correct.
So actually, you know, so the more we have to spend from the general fund, the better off we are, you could argue, because that means our grant that we're getting is larger. It's probably going to be more like, they're not going to give us that whole amount. I mean, these things never go.
The dollar amount available is relatively small.
Right.
So if we ask, and this I think is roughly half of what's available with the state.
They're not going to give us a million. They're going to give us a couple hundred thousand bucks.
If we ask for this, we might get half of it.
Maybe.
Which means the match amount would drop by half as well.
Right.
So.
You're getting, like Mark said earlier, you're getting $4 to every one you spend.
So that's what that was my question. What's the benefit of the 194 or up to the 194?
Well, that allows Jeff to apply for the maximum amount, $1 million.
You get 25 cents on you spend 25 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
Or actually 20 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
How long of a stretch would that buy in the railroad?
And I apologize, you don't have to.
It's $1 million a mile.
But the project limits, and I don't have the exact details, but he's looking to replace rail from milepost zero up to 3.12, and some of the rail has already been upgraded along here, but he didn't indicate which sections remain to be upgraded. But getting up this hill to Rye Yard is really the key.
That was the target that we had all along, and the purpose of doing up to the Rye Yard was to get the UP to deliver the train. So I'm pretty sure that $6 million
Union Pacific doesn't deliver trains to us yet.
They would if our rail was heavy enough.
Well,
that's what they were talking about.
Very sophisticated agreements have to be reached.
I think
for
we
Union.
Need to have Jeff on the conversation.
Yep, so. Well, I'd be happy to call him.
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
It's important.
So, my recollection, what we contributed to the railroad was pretty much what we gave the Shalachie Prairie Railroad, because down here we always operated off that full grant money, and we usually gave in kind or in cash to the Shalachie Prairie Railroad about $12,000 out of that list that we had.
Yep.
That we also pay for the museum. There's about a half a dozen things or more in there.
That's for the upper end, but it's not a lot of money.
We've never done the bottom end with matching funds. I would like to have someone show me that.
We'll have to dig it up. But it's not a common method of funding. I mean, we do all of our... I mean, I don't know how many grants Heath and Carolyn have put in. There was always a local match requirement.
But we're taking it from the general fund,
Jeff?
Not from the road fund.
Right.
That's where we get the matching fund.
Yeah, this is Mark. We've had a spirited discussion about your request for $194,000 in match. And... and I'm not advancing the ball very well, so we thought we'd get you on the phone.
Is Jeff in the building?
No, he's working on an RFP for the Port of Portland for airport concessions. I don't know why he's doing that, but okay. So I'm going to turn it over to the board so they can ask you whatever questions they have remaining.
Okay.
I have a question, Jeff. What was the last grant that we received from the state that required us to have matching or partial matching funds?
So the last time the railroad received a grant from the state was in 2013. We received a $675,000 grant. And at that time, the requirements of the program were a little bit looser about match. And so we put up, I believe, $20,000 in cash and $20,000 in in-kind resources. And the railroad operator, Eric Temple, also put up $10,000.
Okay. That was new to me. The other grants that we had were about $2,000 per biennium that we were given from the state during the session that they had. Those were just outright grants of some sort, right?
Yeah, the program has, the requirements have changed in the last few years. For example, All the projects have to have a cost-benefit analysis. All of the cost estimates have to be PE stamped, and matching is now required to be competitive in the grant pool.
Okay.
Jeff, I'm like be able. I think we're all interested to pursue this further, but we're under the gun here. I understand the window closes Friday. How come? Did you just discover this? I would like to have been ahead of this so we had a little more time to study it and deliberate.
It's a very short turnaround, and it has to do with the tight timing for the transportation revenue package that was passed in early July. They allocated $970,000 to this grant pool, but it's for this biennium, so it has to be expended by July 1 of 2017. So they have to go through the RFP process or the award process. The legislature then meets in their 60-day session and will approve the award that staff at WSDOT recommend, and funding is available July 1 of 2016. So it's a pretty tight turnaround for this particular grant cycle.
Well, what I'm talking about is that we found about it today, and the deadline closes Friday, right? 2 days from now.
Right. So I've been working on this for a couple of weeks since I was made aware of the availability of this program and the timing that the state had to receive proposals. So I've been speccing out a project and talking to staff at the state level, and I changed the scope to more to be more competitive and flexible with what the requirements were for this time around. So we've just in the last week nailed down what we'd like to propose to the state.
It would have been nice to have to let us know, even if you have draft version earlier, to have a little bit more time, because I hate to lose the opportunity for lack of time to be able to give it his due diligence.
Sure, and I apologize for that. You know, again, just trying to respond to the opportunity as best we can.
Hey, Jeff, the 194 number in your letter, that's if they were to award us the maximum amount, the entire pot, right? So what's a more, I mean, for the council, why don't you give them a more realistic number for the general fund at what you think's likely to occur?
Well, what we need to do is basically say we'll match 20% of whatever the state awards. And so, you know, I don't suspect that we'll get all 970,000. It sounds like there are a lot of interested parties in this go-round, but I think we may be able to capture half of that.
Is this an all-or-nothing application, or can we say we'll apply for a certain amount that's less than the maximum?
So that's what we changed in the last week, is we designed the application, so what we're trying to do is replace some of the 85-pound rail that's in the first 3 miles of the railroad that was originally laid between 1921 and 1923, so it's almost a 100-year-old railroad. And we can do that by the foot. So we'll be responsive to whatever award amount they give us, and we'll construct as many track feet as the award amount allows us to do.
So the question is, if we want to apply for half that amount or a fourth that amount, do we have that freedom?
Certainly. We could ratchet back our application. We just need to change the footage that we're proposing to build.
And I would think you've got other applicants in there, too, that whoever looks at divvying up this grant, I would expect they would, I don't know how it works, but it may be that they try to be able to spread it around a little bit more rather than give one entity everything.
That's probably correct, yes.
So it'd be more realistic if we were to apply for a smaller amount. In fact, that may, well, I would say if we're flexible, I guess you already communicated in the application, we'll take what we can get, but it may, we can put a cap on it.
Yes, we definitely can.
Well, I have another question. You done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jeff, over the last 5 years or so, we've collected $6 million from the state transportation money to improve our rail, and I thought we had already had money set aside and was in the process of doing the first miles up to our yard.
What we've done with the grant monies is we have repaired some grade crossings that were becoming significant safety concerns. So we've done several grade crossings. We've done some track work in the yard itself. There were some switches that needed to be replaced. There was some track work out in Battleground that you're familiar with that we needed to change around so that we could better serve Anderson Dairy. We've replaced worn ties. So we've really just addressed a lot of deferred maintenance in the railroad. We did some bridge repairs, replaced some worn bridge stringers and caps and other components of the bridge there at the Cedars Golf Course. But we haven't addressed that 85-pound rail and the hill to a significant degree.
So, Jeff, if we were to put a cap on it, it says our contribution maximum would be 100K. Would that still make sense for us to be able to get the grant that would?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that would make perfect sense. The award may even come in under that, and we would only have to match a smaller amount. So, it's really whatever the board determines they want to do.
So there's not a magic number that if we're going to get, pick out of a number out of the air, you're not recommending something lesser in particular?
No, I'm not. Because there's really almost 3.25 miles of track that need to be replaced. And the funding that's available, the $970,000 plus whatever we would match, would really only get about 25% of that work done.
Okay.
So we're just trying to take as big a bite out of it as we can.
Okay.
So, Jeff, I have a question, too. This is Jeannie Stewart. Can you hear me okay?
Sure, I can hear you fine.
Okay. So, tell me what the relative importance is on this whole economic development package we're trying to do for this industrial area. What's our relative importance of the railroad costs in conjunction with this whole economic development project?
Are you referring to the project out in the Barberton area?
Well, yeah, the first paragraph here, let me read it. Clark County Board of County Councilors recognizes the importance of investing in the Chalachi Prairie Railroad as essential infrastructure to increase our economic development activity. So, regarding that goal, how important is this grant?
It's pretty important. This grant and in subsequent cycles in the years to come, we need to really pursue a pretty aggressive capital campaign to keep the railroad in operation and to modernize it as we try to develop the light industrial land that's along the railroad. And we've identified in both light and heavy industrial zone properties along the railroad corridor, there's about 3,100 acres along all 33 miles of the railroad. So this project addresses the first couple of miles of the railroad, which, if you don't have the first couple of miles, then it doesn't really matter what condition the rest of the railroad's in. You can't get there.
Thanks. I don't know. It sounds
Anything
to
else?
Me like this is has a springboard effect.
Well, return on investment. What can you tell us? I know there's potential there, but suppose it was upgraded now. What would be different? Suppose we had it done.
So really, it's we to the what would be the no-build scenario when you do alternatives analysis. If we did not pursue this project in any way, shape, or form and left that 85-pound rail in, it would continue to deteriorate pretty rapidly, and we may find ourselves in a position where the railroad is not able to service the customers on the line. When it was built, rail cars were 100,000 pounds, and now the cars that are moving on the line are 286,000 pounds. So there's been, it induces significant wear and tear, additional wear and tear on the railroad to move these modern traffic loads. So we've got to address that. It's a safety issue. And eventually we would like the Burlington Northern to use their large locomotives and interchange with us up in the St. John's area instead of down at Fruit Valley Road. But in order to entice them to do that, we've got to upgrade the track so it will support those heavier locomotives.
If they were to do that, I assume they would pay the county for the use of the tracks. How much would they pay annually?
Not until they get to 1,000 cars.
The Burlington Northern wouldn't pay the county. And the leaseholder, the Portland-Vancouver Junction Railroad that currently operates the county line, they pay the county when the car loads per year get over 1,000 cars. And we're well on track to do that. 10 years ago, when Eric Temple took over operations of the railroad, we were moving 40 carloads a year. Last year, we moved 730 carloads, and we're on track to do over 800 this year.
So if we did 1,000 cars per year, what would they pay us?
It's a graduated scale.
If they did 2,000 a year, what would they pay us?
Yeah, there's a scale that's in the contract, and I don't happen to have that in front of me.
It sounds like it's not going to approach 100,000.
It's a pittance. I think it's $10 a car.
Cover weed.
Once you hit 1,000 cars. And then when you hit another threshold, then we get an additional amount, but it remains a pittance.
So
right.
It's but not
the... The return that I would consider on the railroad, the carload revenue to the county, that's a component of it. I'd say that's relatively minor. What we're trying to do is induce rail industrial development along the railroad and the jobs that come along with that.
Steve?
Can I say about that? This would be very beneficial to Legler. We only have one private sector-owned rail-served industrial park of significance in Clark County today. That is the Columbia Business Center down along the water. There's pockets here and there, and a little bit of the Chalachi has some, but Legler would be the only other significant size industrial park that would be rail served, and it's not adequate today in most areas. Every little bit we can do gets it closer to adequate. And then we attract a whole different kind of business and a lot more revenue there. So I think the economic development issue is a little broader than just that return.
And that's what? How many miles up from the starting point here?
10.
Mr. Hornstein there.
Yeah.
So the Wagler property is about 9.5 miles from where the junction with the Burlington Northern Santa Fe is.
So you've got to start there to get to Wagler.
So incrementally, bit by bit. So at this point, we don't have a lot of information, and it is somewhat speculative. However, the timing is use it or lose it. And at this point, for economic development, it is one of our high priorities in this county for business development. So I would be entertaining a motion to go up to our part of $100,000, provided that you can, Mark, I would depend on you to find some savings somewhere, at least to pay for part of that. Do you think you could do that?
I tell you the part that kind of gets me a little bit miffed, and that is for the last 5 years, every time we got the $2 million, we talked about replacing the light rail with the 85-pound track. And all we talked about was getting the heavy rail down down to the bottom of the hill so that the Union Pacific would bring the cars up to Rye Yard. And what you're telling me is that we're out of money and we haven't done that yet.
Well, I guess I should hasten to add that there was even lighter rail in the railroad than the 85-pound rail. We had a lot of 66-pound rail in several areas of the railroad, and that has been replaced and upgraded to heavier track. So I think the 85-pound that we're talking about is a priority project, but it was a lower priority project than the project that had been completed, the 66-pound rail, for example, in prior grants, and the grade crossings that have been improved.
Where's our 85-pound rail now?
It's primarily in that first 3 to 4 miles of the railroad.
The first three?
Right, but there were areas further, like northeast of 78th Street, out going out toward Barberton, where we had a lot of 66-pound rail that was pretty precarious to operate on, and that has been addressed.
You say the first three has the 85-pound track?
Yeah.
Starting where?
Starting just east of where we interchange with the Burlington Northern. So there's some different size tracks in there right at the beginning. For instance, when you cross Fruit Valley Road, we recently upgraded that grade crossing. We put in 136-pound rail. There are spots where there have been spot improvements done, like at the BPA siding. I think there's 112-pound rail in a small section there. But most of that distance is 85-pound rail.
We're pretty much under the clock here deadline, and we have, this is
Thanks, Jeff.
Make or break today, and so I would see if one of my colleagues here is interested in making a motion to approve up to $100,000, provided that Mark can come up with $25,000 in savings, newly identified savings. Is that...
Let's make a deal.
I make a motion that we approve the $194,000. Because this is about the progressive move toward land preparation for high quality jobs and family wage jobs. I would like to see us have a really cohesive package of we have a fee waiver program, which this extra $94,000 is a tiny, tiny amount compared to the valuation that is in the fee waiver program for developers in order to get family wage jobs on that side. And this is, those are to get stuff on the road now. This is to prepare the platform for light industrial and heavy industrial, which are big time jobs and big time salaries. So, can I get a second to $194,000?
Didn't you make a motion?
And she's looking for a second.
I thought you made a motion for $100,000.
I was no.
He
I
said
I,
he was entertaining oh. one of us making
Correct.
A motion for $100,000.
But I mean, I'm not going to give a second, and I'll tell you why. I mean, use the example of the fee waiver. The fee waiver would have no impact on this at all. The fee waiver was as part of the road fund package. And I don't think I could use the fee waiver money if we had kept it or put the fees back on. I don't think I could use that for railroad either. It has to be used within within an area.
No,
so
I'm just
we're not
going to
get the money from there.
Yeah, that wasn't the point. My point is the council has said it wants to do things that are forward-thinking for jobs. The fee waiver program was one of those. This project is another one of those. And if you compare the amount of the ask, which is only the maximum, it may not even end up being the actual. It's a small amount compared to the total amount of fee waivers that we've done. Yeah. So it's just, I'm just saying that to measure our progress or economic development proportionally, that proportionally, I think this is another thrust for economic development. Well,
then you'd have to go to our manager and ask him to double that finding that he's worried about finding for 100,000. So the other problem that I'm having is that we're in the middle of a biennium. We're faced with a supplemental budget today. And I think we have other things in horizon, so I don't want to spend that much. I don't want to commit that much. There's a good chance, because I think I heard from Jeff that there's one or two other people interested in this money. I don't want to find out that we're going to be the only ones who stepped up to the plate, and that we're going to have to step up and go the full 194,000 matching funds. So
okay. Is there
I like the idea of having
that. Is there an alternate motion?
I have a motion on the floor.
So is this dying for lack of a second? Am I dead for lack of a second?
Yeah, so I think so.
So along the line, a little bit lesser, then I make a motion that we make it for 100,000. It's better than nothing, not quite as much as the wish list would be. And I think the 194,000 is in reference to the whole package that the state is offering.
Yeah, he's just asking you for the authority that if the state was to give you the entire pot of money, then you think this project is worth it to match the
project. That scared me to death.
But it's not
going to
happen.
Okay, yeah. So you had a motion to limit our portion, to apply, but limit our portion to 100,000. And I, and if you don't mind,
I've already got the commitment.
A friendly amendment
here,
provided that our county manager can find a new $25,000 savings. I'll second that motion if that's acceptable to you.
I'll accept your second motion.
Okay, and Mark, that's workable.
Did he revise your motion?
Yes.
It was revised.
It's so the concise motion is to authorize the application of the grant. With a limit of 100,000, $100,000 local match, provided that our county manager can identify 25,000 in savings for the general fund.
Why only 25,000?
I'm easy.
I got to find the whole $100,000.
There's been a motion and a second, so you can vote.
No, wait a minute.
You came the motion.
There's appears to be a friendly amendment to Tom's motion. I don't hear Tom agreeing to the friendly amendment.
Well, we're still having the question, why only 25,000? I would think I got to come up with more than that. Where are you going to get the rest of it?
I'm trying to be realistic.
I'm being realistic. Where are you going to get the rest of this?
Talk to our manager here. Mark?
In my budget, my budget, we were going to have to find $100,000.
We've always managed to come up with the match in past years. I'm confident that we'll come up with it this time.
I know we can come up with it. The question is, how much can you save?
I need $100,000.
I can't commit to a dollar amount right here, right now.
Well, what does it mean, the 25, because I'm confused. So he has to identify in the 2016 budget year $25,000 of savings somewhere?
2016? Well, I'm in a...
Jeff will need to ask for
the money will be expended in 2016.
Jeff will need to ask for budget authority to expend this. He'll do that in the spring, depending on whether or not we're successful in obtaining the grant. At the same time, I've got to find whatever amount the board wants me to find in savings.
So it would be in the spring budget amendment.
In other words, this is suppose we were to say that we applied and the state came back and said, "Here, yes, you got something." We still at that point have the freedom and really the authority to say yes or no to any dollar amount, correct?
We will have to accept the grant if the state offers it to us, yes. And okay. We can always say, you know, we applied for this, we've changed our minds.
There's no backing out.
Yeah, we wreck our future if we do that.
We would be fools to put ourselves in a position that we decline a grant because it makes it look like we don't believe in our project. And we're not going to support it. And the minute that message gets out,
we're done.
We can just kiss it goodbye for future grants.
We're not going to turn down $1 million because we have to give up $200,000, are we?
Whose job are you giving up? We have to find all of it. We can't find a fourth of it.
We have 50 minutes.
Yes, we have. We've got lots to do. That was a offer to...
Yeah, my motion is still the same. My manager is going to have to find all of it for the $100,000, unless he can only commit to 50.
Well, would you be acceptable if he finds a portion of it in terms of additional revenue and a portion of it in savings so that the ultimate amount is found, but it's a combination of funding sources?
Yes, that's baby, yeah.
So you're okay.
I mean, and you right. Put it together and you bring it to me. And
but I'm just saying, you're okay with a combination of sources to accommodate the entire
savings
funding
and
sources.
Revenue.
New
right.
It's easier for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, you want to set your motion as you understand
yeah.
it now?
Yeah, that of course I would expect in our budget that we come up with $100,000. Therefore, I make the motion that we accept up to $100,000 of our portion of the matching grant.
Of the 20%. You mean that grant. We would provide authorize up to $100,000?
Yes.
Toward the grant.
Yeah, we have to find those funds in order to authorize that. So.
All right. I'll second the motion.
I think we can find that.
Okay. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, moving on. Thank you very much. Motion passes.
Jeff, are you still there?
I'm still here. Thanks, counselors.
Yeah. Okay.
For bailing me out.
Yeah, talk to Mark.
All right, 2.3, issues regarding the legality of the 179th Street development. Steve Jameson, you're very familiar with this. You represent the developer in this case. You and I have talked earlier, and I've looked over the contract, and we've agreed to just look at this in a positive light, and that is to see what can be done in order to spur economic development on 179th Street. As I see it, this is something where it's a developer's agreement vests all traffic trips on 179th Street to one developer, and in bold here it says, however, county staff is recommending that such a requirement be added. And that's where we have exhibits B, C, D, E, F, and I see a bunch of blank exhibits that have not been done. I also see this is a contract from 2012. In my, we haven't heard anything of any performance at all. And the reason I bring this forward is because I'm aware of multiple businesses who wanted to build in that area, and they are being told no because all the trips belong to someone else that hasn't done a thing in my eyes. And the question is, you related that, yes, there has been some things done, and we want to make sure that everyone is successful. And so I have invited you to be able to share so that perhaps between now and next week you can help us understand how this would make sense and what can be done to move things forward.
Well, before we start there, I'd like to start with legal staff. So, and I think my first question is to you. Why are we looking at this contract again? And I've read it. I have some concerns about what the original contract says too. Are we looking at it now because it ties up capacity and construction hasn't started, so it's like nothing is going and we can't allocate any transportation trips to other developers that might want to go ahead because the trips are tied up in this.
That's right.
Okay. So then I want to ask our legal staff. This contract was written, and I have a question about why it's only signed by one county commissioner.
Under the county code, the chair is entitled to sign. Once there's a vote of the board, The county chair is entitled to sign on behalf of the entire board, and I'm sure that's what happened in this case, that the chair signed, that you'll find that the signator in this case was the chair, or the chair was gone, and the signator was the co, or, you know, the chair for the day. But that's the reason that only one person signed.
Okay. So, this is a really unusual contract. Even for a development agreement, it's really unusual because it does not require, it does vest. Is this agreement vested?
It provides.
Legally vested.
Well, vesting has, in most constructs or most contexts, vesting relates to land use development rights. So I'll talk about it in that context. Yes, this project is vested for, or this development was vested for 10 years. And I think probably the concurrency approval is for that same entire period. Although I haven't got it in front of me right now, I will tell you, yes, it is vested. In fact, that's a specific subsection of that agreement and provides for it, but I believe it's for 10 years.
And it does say that the development agreement alone, pre-application.
Before they've gotten site plan.
Yes,
because what had happened was, this project came in, as Mr. Hornstein proposed it for the board, this project came in when they had one parcel of a number of parcels, but they had one segment of land that they had tied up, and that they had some additional land they were looking at acquiring, and Mr. Killian was looking at making a fairly substantial investment in this property with an attempt to build with a goal of building a fairly large commercial development, and he needed to line up an anchor tenant. He needed some commitments of capacity to be able to bring those to fruition, and 15. The board, and we hadn't even completed all of the, he hadn't even completed all the transportation analysis, and so this study, or this agreement, didn't even include a number of agreements that were subsequently filed in the succeeding year. But it very much was a bare-bones agreement and was anticipating or documents that were going to be submitted in the future.
Okay, so this was vested before the fee waiver program came about.
Well, there was one fee waiver program in place, and that's something that only Mr. Hornstein can speak to. I actually have an email from him. I've saved it. Because originally there was a lot of discussion about whether this project would pay TIFs, and there was, our office believed, a commitment to pay impact fees. Then there was some changes in the language that left that open to question. So I contacted Mr. Hornstein and said, we need to make it clear that notwithstanding, at that time it was the 2012 ordinance and the 14 job fee waiver. And I said, we need to make it clear that notwithstanding the 2012 ordinance, that your client is prepared to and is committing to pay traffic impact fees. And he said yes. So that language was added to the agreement, and you'll find that on there. Now, that while that was after the 2012 ordinance, it predates the more recent ordinance that waives TIFs for commercial projects, and so that issue is somewhat of an outstanding issue.
Okay. That was my question. Based on the previous agreement, or series of agreements, it appears that they were going to be assessed a traffic impact fee.
Yes.
And then I was wondering how the 2014 fee waiver program impacted this. In other words, did it waive these fees too? But because this is a pre-written development agreement, this agreement stands on its own.
My best argument would be that given the specific commitment to pay traffic impact fees, that Mr. Hornstein's client, Killian, and the LLC that he's a part of would be obligated by contract to pay this amount. That's not to say that argument still doesn't exist in light of the legislative enactment the board has passed, but I'll leave that for Mr. Hornstein to speak to.
It is a question.
It is.
That still is active.
Yes.
And I'm sure you have your case lined up here. So have we ever before had a development agreement where we allowed vesting for transportation for 10? In one place it says 10 years, and then in another place in here it refers to a 15-year time frame.
I forgot about the 10 versus 15. We've had, the board has approved a number of development agreements. The closest one to this project was the Patton Park agreement that Randy Prince promoted on behalf of Providence Hospital. And in that case, Randy's primary argument was a commitment to bring medical dental jobs, and the board committed to give access to the Patton Parkway, which we had previously said we would never do. And it was because it was critical to the development of that project, and I believe that was at least a 10-year development commitment. In terms of similar size projects, you had the Hazeldell Town Center that was also a mixed-use development that changed. It evolved. I'll say evolved. I'll be nice about it. Because they gave up residential after a couple of years.
Free site plan approvals.
I understand. I'm just saying it started out in one phase and then changed. And that had a period of protection also. But we've done it in the past.
We have. Okay. So just so that we all understood what some of the bases is for this agreement. And it does seem to me to have, having seen many development agreements over the years at City of Vancouver, my former career here, there are some unusual grants in this that are atypical.
I would agree with you, and in fact, if you were to listen to the hearing, my guess is you'd probably, and I think Mr. Hornstein would tell you, I was not a promoter. I'll leave it at that. But
the word difficult comes to mind.
Well, and I'm sure you and I might share some of the same concerns because I've been reading this for a couple days. Anyway, thank you for that pause so that some of the groundwork could be laid for those of us that weren't here when this was approved.
Sure. Let me just lay the groundwork in a real concise way, reading from the staff report that introduced this. Under background, it says, this proposed agreement is unique. It says this is one of a kind. It's never been done before. It says staff recommendation. It recommends actions that were expected to be done, and they were not done. It says in here, the agreement would provide Three Creeks investors with certain development rights for 15 years. This reservation would assign that roadway capacity, that's basically all of the roadway capacity, to Three Creeks investors development only, such that it would be not available to other developers in the area. This could preclude, and in this case, it does preclude all other developments from the building area.
And that's a reason that to knowingly put a stick in somebody else's spokes, we should not have allowed that.
Well, at this point, we haven't...
I don't mean you and I weren't here, but yes. I mean, I don't think that's a good finding for a government to make.
So, and I understand, and that's really what I was questioning here. So certainly, it's because the intent behind this is to, let's get some development going out there, and here's some incentive to do so. And that was 2012. This also says in here that the obligation of this is to communicate with the county. As for progress, none of that this happens since I've been here.
Not at your level, but it is happening.
Oh, okay. Well, so the question is, how can we, or in fact, before I even get to that question, now that the fee waiver program is there for all development, business development, of anything that this would qualify, there is no dollar advantage at all to hand anything like this to a developer that locks out all of the developers. There's not a dollar of value and amount there. So the question is, what I'm relating is the way we see it. And you can enlighten us how we can see it different and how somehow I would like to be able to see this developer do something, because I've received multiple notices from other developers who would have already built, and they haven't because of this. So, Steve, help us out here.
Before you get too far into that, let me share something that's relevant, and that is within the last 2 to 3 months, I've met with Killian, and they are moving ahead. In fact, they have actually drafted the drawing of the road in which they intend to build. And so maybe we don't see it here, but it was shared for us to accept what they have put forward with the intent of doing as part of their impact fee, I believe. So, and I don't think that there was, and I agree with our legals that when this was drafted up, that there was no traffic impact fee waiver. And therefore, that this
well, not the current one,
right?
The 14 job waiver was
right,
in effect,
right? That this would relate to that one. But I think, in all good faith, my conversation is that Killian is moving forward with the building in lieu of paying the fee of building the road. So
there's been a lot of discussion so far on this topic that is contractual, about contract law and legal in nature. I'm not here to address that today. David and I agreed that I wouldn't go there, and he wouldn't go there, and even if we hadn't had that conversation, this is not the forum for that kind of conversation. All I'll say about that is I am very certain about the enforceability of this agreement, so let's just put that on the table and leave it there, okay? This project presents an opportunity for the county to build out the last interchange on I-5 that isn't built out. I say that because there's one at the center that's being built out privately. This one will be built out as a public-private partnership. And that's it. We got them all. It opens the Discovery Corridor a great deal. The Killians have two options here, what I've agreed to with David is to come in next week with Lance Killian and lay it all out for him. I guess you've had that already, Tom.
I did.
If you want that, we'll do it. If you're not concerned about that, we don't have to, but we are going to do it with David. Just let me know if you want to hear, get an update on the project, so to speak. There are two options for Killian here. One is to build out just enough to get its project approved, and it's going to build a lot of roadways, and I imagine 179 is on the capital facilities plan, so we've got the juxtaposition of a fee waiver, no fee waiver to speak of at the time of the agreement. How does that work out, and what kind of TIF credits are available, because we're going to build a major portion of a road there to make the interchange work. So we have the ability to go forward and do enough to build the project, or we can participate on a much broader basis in the rebuilding of that interchange. Those are the conversations we've had very recently with Heath and Jeff Swanson, and there's an assumption on Killian's part that it's better for the community to build to participate in a way that facilitates the entire interchange improvement. You probably heard that, or build things now to get the project done, but with some of which would be torn out if you don't go forward. The traffic work that's been done, the market study, I saw the market study in a recent meeting that took my breath away, what rebuilding that interchange does to job creation in the way an economist looks at that area. And we'll bring that, for that report for you to read. So Killian, in the interim, has acquired now the northern part of across the street from the, he's acquired the northeast corner now of the property, larger than the southeast corner that we were originally working with by three times. Fair amount of wet in it, but it's a lot bigger. There's talk of realigning 15th from the south through that. There's just a whole lot of opportunity for the county in this project. If you stymied, if you attempted to stymie this project, we probably would do our damnedest to see that you couldn't, but assuming you could, and you gave the trips that are reserved in this development agreement to three or four other projects, that's all you get, because you've lost the private sector, unless you want to condemn right-of-way from Killian on both sides of 179, which is not something you, as a matter of policy, you don't do very often and don't like to do. All of a sudden, the entire interchange project is stymied by this. And I don't want to get into too much more detail today, because I think it's Lance's purview to lay out for you precisely what's going on with this project, which I didn't realize he'd done that for you, Tom. That's, I'm glad.
It was great.
One meeting we don't have to have. But you could force them to do the short-term project with some throwaway stuff, or you can take their willingness to be part of the entire interchange solution that will create a huge number of opportunity for jobs in the area. That's really the choice. Could he move quickly? Sure. That's not the county's best interest. It's not the community's best interest. We will come in and explain that to you, Commissioner Medora and Commissioner Stewart, if she so chooses.
Okay, I got a question. All good contracts and agreements are mutually beneficial. And what I'm looking for when we meet and you explain what's going on there is how this benefits the community.
Well,
because it looks to me like it benefits one
that's
party.
That's not a contract issue.
I think that we have to be careful, if I'm not right, that we're dabbing into an area that probably should be dealt with in an executive session.
We're not, thank you, Tom. I'm not going to talk to you about the legalities of the contract. We're going to talk to you in a meeting with Lance.
Which is where I'm going.
If you want to do that, then we need to have Chris there. That's a very different conversation.
I'm not looking at any of that. I'm looking at what this does. You, by what you just shared, would lead me to believe that somehow this developer and this contract is going to pay for the 179th Street interchange improvement.
I didn't say
that. Okay.
It's a partnership.
So the 179th Street interchange is funded independently. There's nothing in here that requires this contractor to do anything or to pay anything.
It's not that simple.
Okay. So why don't we just wrap it up for now?
Yeah.
I need to be educated. I'm open to understand what I don't understand now. Yeah. And between now and next week, please.
I have Lance's times on my phone, in an email and mine, and I'll stop and schedule it when I.
Okay.
But I don't. Let me be clear again. This is not going to be discussing the legality of the contract. I've written lots of these. I've done these in other jurisdictions besides the county. It's not that unique. I mean, it's got some unique provisions in it, but it's not unique in its approach. I've done a number of times.
Are you okay to move on to the next topic?
I'm okay to move on, but I think there are some unresolved possibilities here. So
I assume, Steve, you're going to spend time with us one-on-one.
Well, I will with you. I don't. It sounds like you need it again, Tom.
No.
Do you want a meeting to look at the project?
It was good.
Not. I don't want to talk to you about the legalities of the contract or the issues you have, but the project itself.
Mr. Killian and a group of people have met with me on two or three occasions to talk to me about what their concept or sense of possibilities are on 179th, and I'm sure that it's
be the same thing.
The same thing. Yeah. So
Sounds like we just missed you, David.
But I still have other issues that.
Well, you take those up with Chris. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And with that, no, hear no objection, move on to 2.4. Thank you very much, Steve.
I look forward to
please make an arrangement
as soon as possible.
Yeah,
I'll do it on the way out.
Okay. Okay, 2.4, islands impacting commercial property. Steve, you also can offer some insight there. If you could first just simply help us to know, from your point of view, we talked about this in a previous board time. You were going to go off and talk with parties and come back. The question is, would you let us know where we are at now and what the path, suggested path forward is?
I think we're making significant progress. Well, and I hate to say that because, as Heath will tell you, this guy's squirreling. But as of today, we're making progress forward on this. We've got his attention. We understand what he wants. We have some things besides cash we can provide to him. We're hoping to meet up on the site early next week. We have some people out of town issues getting everybody there at the same time. And seeing if we can come to an understanding that could be put into an agreement.
So if that agreement works out the way you think it is, then the medians as they are proposed now do not have to change. They can stay in place.
I'm
just asking.
It doesn't really have much to do with the median. It has to do with, it has to do with providing access because of the medians, I guess.
You know. So I want to get involved before that. So that's what I said. You're getting the horse.
We're working on
the cart ahead of the horse here. And one of the things I want to bring back to this board for a better understanding as to where we stand in our ordinance that we have that is very, very clear that we do not impede commercial property. And somewhere along the way, someone gave me a numerous pages of our ordinances and building laws, I guess, but they neglected to include the part that, and I'm not sure if you have this yet. I'm going to push that out there for you. I have a couple of these. Basically, what it says is that until the car count is up to 20,000 per day, that we do not interfere with commercial property, and this is just one of them that they're talking about. On this particular one, if you go back and look at the car count estimated for the year 2035, it still isn't back up to the 20,000 car count that we have here. So in all safety aspects and requirements that we have per to the year 2035, we are well under that and outside of any danger. We also went back and looked at the state portion, and I think you also have a copy of that. And it refers to being looked at when the speeds of over 45 miles an hour. I think unless we plan on changing that, it's still 45 miles an hour. In fact, at that intersection, reality is probably more at 25 miles per hour. So what I'm here in front of the board is to ask that we give directive to Public Works to follow the ordinance that we have in place on commercial zoning.
Is this an urban arterial?
Yes.
Because I'm looking at the first sentence on that. It says, urban arterial shall generally include raised medians. Can you help us understand, Keith?
So the part of the code that Councillor Mielke is looking at, where it talks about the volumes, is intended for example, we looked at this down on 72nd when we're on the north-south long tangent of 72nd Avenue between the major intersections. Always at the major signalized intersections, the ADT does not drive the need or not need for the median. What we're trying to do with the intersections themselves, there's another part of the code, and I can't tell you the number, where we say within 250 feet of a signalized intersection, all of those should be protected by median. And that is to make sure that we are considering safety and operational needs. So what the 20,000 part of the code is intended for is when you're in long tangents and the volume of the roadway overall is lower, then maybe we could use a continuous left turn lane rather than the median. So that's exactly what we chose on 72nd Avenue and how we were able to justify not including them, even though the road standard called for the median anyway. So it allowed us to have that ability to make that call. And that's actually, by code, it's Heath's decision based on a traffic study that does or doesn't support the median overall. So there's a little bit difference between, there's different parts of the code that apply in different segments or intersections of the arterial roadways. Yep. Does that help? Do you understand that?
I understand where you're coming from. I also included in your packets there, at a glance, several other intersections that don't have that. And
that don't have the medians?
Has driveways much, much closer to the corner than the one on 119th and 78th. 78th and 78th is one of the photographs. There's my other measurements. The other one was, I gave you two. You have two photographs. 78th and St. John's. Oh, and the new intersection we just built going into our yard.
That's 47th Avenue.
No islands. So either you do or you don't. But more importantly, that we follow the code that we have here, unless there's truly a high count in the year 2035, based on our estimate, we're only halfway there.
Right, so, and that is more intended for the tangents between intersections, the segments between intersections, not the intersections themselves.
So, along this case, and I think it's very important that this body give directive that we follow this, and we're well under all requirements, well under the speed limit. And the most recent intersection that you built does not have islands out there. So I think in this case, in future cases, it should be more time spent on it and not be included in this case or future cases. Or we have to go back and change the others. That's not our goal. Our goal is to be business friendly, and unless somewhere down the road the situation changes, that we not put the islands and dividers up. Any questions from the board? To me? If there's no question,
yes,
I'd like to make a motion. So.
I have a question.
Okay.
I can't hear you, Tom.
No, I want input back so I can answer some questions if it's not clear on the information I've given you, showing the other intersections that don't have the islands. And along with the fact is that we're supposed to be business friendly. And according to the ordinance that we drafted 3 years ago in the effort to be more business friendly, that unless dire things make a difference, that we not impede with islands or curbing. You had a question?
Yeah. How close? Does this become moot if you were to reach the agreement that you're thinking?
Oh.
It could.
But remember, the county spent closer to 2 years than a year trying to get this done. It precedes Heath. And you're asking me to get it done in a couple of weeks, and it's the same squirrely guy. I think I've made progress with him, but I can't tell you when it'll be done.
Yeah.
I can't tell you.
Hey, and on this particular one, it would only improve if you could reach an agreement with the neighbor.
Yeah.
But if you can't, we still resort back to the second alternative, and that is to allow left in, left out on 119th.
The Let me just ask a question. Do we know yet when, in the normal course, the islands would go in? How much time do we have?
I'll be honest with you, we don't. I mean, today, it's very weather-dependent at this point in time. So typically, we would end roadway paving mid-October, just based on history. But if we have good weather, we've tried to create our specifications such that we can allow work to continue until the weather doesn't allow it. So it's coming soon. It could, if it doesn't happen within the next few weeks, it probably won't happen until next year.
So I'm in a very unusual position here. We all are, for this reason. The county tried and was unsuccessful in getting the problem solved. The installation of the medians, as you know, will have an immediate negative effect on the business. I'm going to talk about legal liability, but that becomes the issue then. I'm trying to fix it so for you and for the client so we don't have to have that conversation about county liability. And the longer you can wait, the better. That's what I think.
And I don't know if it's of any help at all, but I do think, and it's not my area of expertise, our expertise is on the transportation system, but there are studies out there, and that actually, as we've been sitting here looking up from Utah, talking about this very question that was studied about installing medians, because it's a very common perception that you're putting a median in, you're cutting off my access, we're going to lose business. The study, this particular one in Utah, studied several businesses, all with the very same concern, and their businesses did not decrease. Actually, they increased over time because there's additional traffic with new roadway, improved safety and access overall. So I don't know. I think that the discussion about losing business is, we don't really know that the answer to that. What we do know is that putting in medians improves safety in these particular locations, and that's what this is about. And I honestly don't think that Mr. Hornstein would disagree that us putting in the median is an important part of the overall intersection.
Well, I do have some experience with the impact of limiting access, whether it's riding right outs or medians or whatever, on business. And it's very fact dependent. Let's talk about Costco, which was in the county when we permitted the Costco on Andreessen. And we cut off the access off Andreessen after a short period. It hasn't affected business there. It doesn't appear to have affected business there because Costco is a destination. And Minute Mart is not a destination. And we know from all those signatures on those people coming from the north that it's not going to work for them to go in there anymore. So if I were the county and I was worried about sort of the outcome of this, I wouldn't bet on the fact that business will stay the same or improve. It's pretty clear to me it's not going to.
I think that we're well aware of that. We do have some unusual circumstances that this would have to happen. In this particular case, I don't think that's one of them. But I think that we should be focusing on the ordinance that we put in place for the reason that we put it in place, and that we expect it to be followed unless there's an unusual circumstance, at which time that we like to be involved in that, recognizing the unusual circumstance.
I have to disagree with you, Counselor. We have never used ADT as a design criteria. It's a design criteria that says what the capacity of the road is designed to handle in the long term. It's never been intended for the purposes of setting the beginning framework for when medians are required. In fact, medians are required with new construction. Now, there's a great many roads that the county has that we haven't improved, and it may be that this reference to the engineer having the ability to create an exception, because what we're talking about is an exception. It's not the rule, and the exception is where in spans of the road it's safe to use left turns in lieu of a median, then that's a potential. But in an interchange, I mean, actually, there's two things involved. I'll talk about the road standards first and then the safety, or road standards and safety first, and then the second issue being our grant funding, which funds a good many of these improvements. But from the road standards and the safety, from road standards and a safety standpoint, those are required with new construction, either if the county does it or if a developer does it. That's true all the way back to Fred Meyer's on 139th and any number of projects that have gone in on other arterials in the county road. We didn't wait till 134th and Tenney, 139th had 20-some thousand. We put in medians when those things began. 139th has medians on it, and a number of county roads do. So it really hinges more on when they were built, when they were designed and built, and when they've been last upgraded. As to this discretion that the county engineer has, Carolyn spoke a little bit about the fact that there are segments, and as you get more rural, certainly it makes more sense to provide some additional flexibility because you're not going to have the same turning conflicts around the intersections as where we have conflicts and the whole basis for our getting grant funding in the first place. I mean, the money that we got for those was because we knew there were accidents going on and they had to be fixed. And certainly Mr. Hornstein's familiar with those because a good many of them happened at or right near his business or his client's business. So the ability of the county to get funding was to fix a problem, and it's because we know that at interchanges or intersections is where you're more likely to find conflicts and where medians become an important component in protecting people against bad decisions.
I'm not commenting on the safety issues.
That's fine. You're not required. I think your insurer or your client's insurer probably would rather you not. But the intersection issues are pretty well documented. We can show you the accidents that have occurred over the last 10 years that occurred at the vicinity of 119th and 72nd. So I think I've got to respectfully disagree that we are not required or somehow it's a violation of our county road standards to require median or to wait. Let me say it differently. I believe it is erroneous to believe that we have to achieve 24,000 vehicles a day before we can put medians in. That's not what the road standards say.
That maybe we should have addressed that before we made the ordinance. But the ordinance was made with the engineering department.
I agree with you, but I don't think that's what it says. It says medians are required. It doesn't say they're only required when you get to 24,000. The ADT is the capacity of the road, and so what it says is when you build it, the more lanes, obviously, the more cars it can handle, and the bigger the road is, the more traffic it can handle, and so it tells us that as a road gets towards capacity, that it's about time for the county to be thinking about parallel supplemental roads that have a similar function, so 72nd, 117th, 182nd, and so forth. We build those roads to handle a certain amount of traffic, and when they get up to capacity, we know it's time to go forward. That's not intended to be a threshold any more than the minimum road width is intended to be a threshold, or capacity is intended to set when you build the road to its minimum width.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case here. If we talk about this specific one, but we were really concerned with, and if you look at the pictures that I shared there, there's a four businesses in all four corners that we've talked about intensely in the past about not cutting off access to those businesses. This one here is more isolated than the others. The car count estimated in the year 2035 doesn't come close to the maximum that they're talking about here.
Which is probably a good thing because it's going to be an expensive road to replace.
We don't even meet the state requirement on miles per hour that we have. When we're it's a 40 mile per hour road, and the state starts putting barriers or restrictions at 45 miles per hour. There's a lot of different circumstances, and our intent with the ordinance that we did 3 years ago was that we take more consideration when we do this. In this case, I don't think it was. In future cases, I think we need to look at it very closely. If this was really that important, that new road that we built into our yard should all have islands and barriers and left turn restrictions, four lanes. So we're not consistent in what we've done. And so I think that under unusual circumstances and special circumstances, it should be that way. But under the ordinance that we looked at before and we made before based on the information that we worked with our engineers, that we have this new ordinance that we give consideration to not cutting off access to commercial property.
The problem the board will face, number one, is it will impact your ability to get grant funding in the future. But the more fundamental problem you have is that arterials and collectors are designed to carry large volumes of traffic. Now, you don't have to put median.
It's a two-lane road.
I beg your pardon?
It's a two-lane road.
You can have 72nd Avenue can carry at 50 miles an hour a heck of a lot of traffic because I travel on it frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And so the speed, it's a combination of the number of lanes and the speed of the traffic that flows on a particular road. What I'm suggesting is you can take a four-lane road if you choose, and you can open it up to and take away the medians if you choose to change the speeds and do certain other design parameters. The effect, however, is that you're going to reduce its ability, its capacity to handle traffic. And so what you've done is spent a great deal of money building a very expensive road, and then you've limited its ability to carry traffic because collectors and arterials are designed to handle carry traffic over larger periods. The shorter the neighborhood collectors and the local access roads are supposed to provide for this turning movement and other things, but they are the arterials and collectors are designed to move traffic and keep it going. And that's why the more access points there are onto a collector or arterial, the more it slows down and reduces its capacity. So the board has a lot of flexibility about how you want to do it. You just have to understand that the effect of changing that will be that you're going to need more of these parallel roads. They're expensive to build, and that it's going to reduce the capacity of the road.
I totally agree with you in certain circumstances. I don't think in this case it reaches that goal in the year 2035, nor do we have anything, an accident record of 5 years I'd like to see, which has been reduced immensely so. And if we're going to do that, then where are the islands on 78th Street turning into our yard?
Well, 78th Street has limited right-of-way width. I won't defend that because I don't know enough details about it in truth.
I'm just using it for
a good
example
of important
more
point.
traffic and the same speed limit.
Again, I'll let others talk about it because we don't do something right, and I can't, again, I'm not going to address that issue because I don't know all the right-of-way widths and what alternatives exist out there, doesn't mean that it's correct. It just means we should follow the same standard, and I agree with you on that completely. But it doesn't mean the standard's a bad standard or that you should make a standard a bad standard. The truth is that we have an obligation to protect the public who reasonably use our roads for their intended purposes, and if we don't protect them, we're responsible for that.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, the problem is, however, that when you have medians that assure that you have a certain storage space for left-hand turn lanes, and you take those away and you allow people to cut in front of each other, you introduce the possibility for T-bone accidents. People going one direction who would normally turn left, and somebody's trying to turn left to cut in front of them, especially depending on how busy traffic is, sets almost up the assurance that you're going to have a T-bone accident that the median is intended to prevent. And so I'm getting out of my element. I'm only talking about experience because I've defended enough of these accidents.
I want to reassure you, though, that island on 219th Street, which is 50 mile an hour plus that the state's putting up, full length barriers, we're going to have T-bones on the intersections.
We are nearly out of time.
We beat this to get to death.
Either
we take ordinances and throw them out the window, or we accept the ones we have, or we change the ones we have. But on the scenario that we have, to put this to bed and get it done right, I'd like to make a motion that we give the directive at this time, until we have unusual circumstances, that we follow our ordinance that we have.
Tom, I want to support you, I want to support the business, and I want to ensure that we don't violate any safety standards. this is an important conversation, but I need to have some more conversation to ensure that I cast an informed vote. We're out of time. We need more time. So if you'd be patient with me, Tom, I know we've been beating this to death. We've been talking about it for a long time.
Have.
It's a long-term solution.
And I brought to you the state rules and when they imply them. I showed you examples of a couple of intersections we just built. You can't say that we're special and therefore we don't do it.
I got one last thing to cover. So, Tom, please be patient with me. Next week, I'll have conversations between
back
now
next
and
next week.
The last
to
thing
that point, before we leave that mm-hmm. point,
brief, please.
Well, I wish you would have asked Tom to be brief so that I could at least
I was brief.
Say,
it was Chris.
So I'm going to drag it out just to torture you.
We're just keeping two people from their appointments, and I'm just aware of that.
Well,
go on,
then the correction needed to happen earlier on. So, Tom, the code that you're reading from,
so Chris, you're
the
free.
Second part of the statement is, and where county engineer makes the determination that the roadway will operate safely and without operational problems. So we do need to consider that's a whole part of the whole statement.
Pretty broad.
Well,
and
it's
therefore,
broad, but
that's when I say we need to bring it back to us when we have unusual circumstances so we don't hear about it after the fact. I'm sorry.
Okay, thanks for being around. I'll try to make it very brief. State Representative Liz Pike offered to present to the RTC board last night options for upgrading the seismic capacity or tolerance of our I-5 Columbia River Bridge. They voted not to have her present that, and she's had a lot of meetings. She's done a lot of interviews and spent many hours on this, and I talked with her after the meeting and encouraged her, and I would induce it here for us to be able to welcome her to present it to us as at one of our televised meetings. And so I'd like to be able to see if we can extend that invitation and work with Mark to make that happen.
We're going to do a time frame.
We'll figure out what works mutually.
Yeah.
Well, the framework and the purpose of that is information mm-hmm. and has. Even before we would get to that, I would want to know if there's ever been a study. I believe there was a study done on upgrading the seismic structure of the I-5 bridge, or a study done to see if it could be done or if it was feasible. So can we get that information in advance so that we have a perspective of what's happened before? Because I don't know what Liz has in mind. I don't know what information. What I don't understand is this a seismic upgrade thrust versus a replacement thrust, or is it in addition to a third bridge? I'm not sure what the framework is. Do we know what the framework
so
is?
Let me share what I heard.
Okay.
I heard that she has information and approximate cost of seismic retrofitting of that bridge as part of it. And, we say it's just information. I think it's very important that we have that information. To withhold information from the general public is terrible. And I think that we would encourage her to come, but we need to put sideboards on it to 10 to 15 minutes.
Are you saying that somebody has been withholding that information?
At the meeting, they didn't want to hear it.
Well, It wasn't offered there, so I don't think they. I think we made the rejection of it was on a whole different matter. I don't think it had to do with the.
I must have missed something. I thought for sure they voted no. Okay.
You know, there's always the why, Tom.
Okay.
There's always the why.
Yeah. So, do we have a consensus? It's okay to invite her in. We don't know what we don't know, and I expect that she'll be able to answer those questions.
What forum is this going to be in?
Hearing.
Well, it wouldn't be a hearing, per se.
We don't, at this point, it's to introduce it and invite it, and I expect that our county manager with state representative will work out something that would be appropriate. This is just simply to open the door and say, we welcome you. Is that okay?
It is, but I'd also like legal to be there to make sure that we're doing this in a balance.
That sounds they normally are. That's a good idea.
Okay.
Okay, we have a consensus?
Yep.
Okay, all right. That sounds very good. Is anything else?
No.
I'll wave it.
Peter?
Nothing.
Okay. Axel? Okay. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
We're adjourned. Thank you.
Good.